If you look at the magazine covers right now, or just scroll through any health tech feed, you would honestly think we have totally cured PTSD.
Oh, absolutely. The hype is everywhere.
Right. Millions of venture capital dollars are just pouring into psychedelic therapies, mainly things like MDMA and ketamine. And the hype is immense. I mean, it is sometimes deafening.
It is, yeah. And it constantly lumps these two very different compounds together under this broad umbrella of psychedelic therapy.
Which gives everyone this false impression that they're basically just two different flavors of the exact same medical revolution.
Exactly. And that could not be further from the truth.
Which is exactly what we are pulling apart today. We're using a fantastic new article from the June 2026 edition of the OOTW Journal. But I want to give you a sobering reality check to kick off today's deep dive.
This is the part that usually gets buried in the headlines.
Yeah, as of today, in June of 2026, neither of these drugs is actually FDA approved for the treatment of PTSD.
Not a single one.
Right. So to really understand what is happening here, I want you to think of trauma like a structurally damaged house. Like, you own this house, but the foundation is cracked, the wiring is completely shot, and, simply living inside of it has become this daily, exhausting struggle for survival.
That's a really vivid way to frame it.
Thanks, yeah. So if you call in contractors to fix it, MDMA and ketamine represent two entirely different proposals for how to save your house.
Completely different approaches.
Right, so one contractor offers a tool that lets you safely walk into the most unstable, terrifying rooms, do a deep psychological demolition, and then painstakingly rebuild the foundation from the dirt up.
Right, while the other contractor says, "Well, look, we don't have time for demolition. I have a tool that can rapidly patch the physical wiring of the house overnight, so, the lights turn back on by tomorrow morning."
Exactly. And that structural analogy really captures the landscape perfectly, I think.
It really does. Because to understand why these treatments are so fiercely debated right now and, why the FDA is struggling so hard to regulate them, we first have to look at the biology.
Let's get into that biology, because my natural assumption, and I think a lot of people's assumption, is that if two drugs are targeting the exact same condition, they must share some, I don't know, underlying mechanism.
Yeah, that makes sense intuitively, but MDMA and ketamine are fundamentally operating on totally different software and hardware systems in the brain. They take almost entirely opposite biochemical routes to arrive at that same destination of reducing PTSD symptoms.
Okay, so let's break that down. What is the software for MDMA?
So the logic behind MDMA is fundamentally psychological, but it's driven by a highly specific neurochemical cascade. It acts primarily on the brain's serotonin system by binding to a protein called the serotonin transporter, or SERT.
Okay, cert.
Right. Now, in the normal brain, this transporter acts like a biological vacuum cleaner. Its job is to just sweep up excess serotonin from the synapses, which are the gaps between your neurons.
Okay, so it cleans up the chemicals.
Right, but MDMA comes in and actually reverses the motor on that vacuum.
Oh, wow. So instead of cleaning up the serotonin, it forcefully pumps all of it out into the brain.
Exactly, it floods the system. And it doesn't stop with serotonin. That reversal also triggers a massive release of dopamine, norepinephrine, and crucially, oxytocin.
Oxytocin, which we often call the bonding hormone,
The
right?
bonding or trust hormone, yes.
Which brings us to the actual patient experience. What does that chemical flood actually feel like for someone who is suffering from severe trauma?
Well, the most compelling part of the MDMA research, and specifically if we look at the work of Nardou and colleagues from back in 2019, is how this drug affects the amygdala.
Which is the brain's threat detection center.
Exactly. For a person with PTSD, that center is chronically hyperactive. It's just stuck in the on position.
Like it's constantly scanning for danger.
Right, which makes the mere thought of revisiting a traumatic memory completely unbearable for them. But MDMA artificially quiets that threat center, while that flood of oxytocin artificially elevates feelings of profound safety and interpersonal trust.
So it's basically creating a safe biological bubble.
Yes. The hypothesis is that this chemical state literally reopens a critical period of social reward learning. It opens this temporary biological window where the brain finally feels safe enough to learn new associations.
So it's essentially like turning off the blaring, deafening fire alarm in your brain so you can finally walk into the burning room and safely put out the fire of the traumatic memory.
That is a perfect analogy, yeah.
Because without the drug, the alarm is so loud and the physical panic is so overwhelming that you just can't even get close to the memory to process it with a therapist.
Exactly. The drug itself isn't doing the healing. MDMA isn't the cure, it's just the fire suit that lets you do the work.
That's a really crucial distinction. It's a psychological catalyst.
Right. But when we look at ketamine, that logic is completely inverted.
Okay, so how does ketamine work?
Well, ketamine does not care about opening you up to do deep psychological processing. Its logic is directly neuroplastic.
Meaning it's physically changing the hardware of the brain, regardless of what the patient is even thinking about.
Yes, and doing it with astonishing speed. Ketamine is a dissociative anesthetic, right? So instead of serotonin, it works on glutamate, which is the brain's main excitatory neurotransmitter.
Okay, glutamate.
Right, and it acts as an NMDA receptor antagonist. By blocking these specific receptors, ketamine forces the brain to trigger this paradoxical massive surge of glutamate.
And the OOTW article points out that this glutamate surge activates specific signaling pathways in the brain, namely the BDNF and MTOR pathways.
Yes, which sounds incredibly dense, I know.
It does. But from what I gather, we can basically think of BDNF as like biological Miracle-Gro for the brain. Right?
Hey, Miracle-Gro is the exact right way to describe it, because chronic stress and severe trauma, they act like a prolonged drought in the brain. Yeah, and over time, that drought literally causes the branches of your neurons, these tiny structures we call dendritic spines, to wither and shrink.
Oh, wow. So trauma literally shrinks your brain cells.
Specifically in the prefrontal cortex, yes, which is the area that governs emotional regulation.
Yeah.
So ketamine acts as a rapid-release fertilizer for those areas.
Okay, so it activates the BDNF.
Exactly. By activating those BDNF pathways, it forces the brain into a state of rapid synaptogenesis. Literally within hours of an infusion, those withered neuronal branches begin to sprout new leaves.
That is incredible. Within hours.
Within hours. It physically rebuilds the synaptic connections that the trauma eroded.
So if we tie this back to you, the listener, and that house analogy we started with, MDMA is the deep guided demolition. It creates the psychological window of safety for you to mentally process the trauma.
Right.
But ketamine is acting directly on the hardware. It's rapidly regrowing the physical wiring that the stress destroyed.
Exactly. And because these drugs are doing such vastly different things biologically, the actual clinical experience, you know, what actually happens when a patient walks into a clinic, has to look completely different.
Yeah, the delivery models are polar opposites. Because MDMA requires the patient to actively process their trauma, the treatment model is intensely psychotherapy-centric.
Highly intensive. If you look at the phase 3 clinical trials, participants aren't just handed a pill and sent on their way. They receive the drug only 2, maybe 3 times over the course of several months.
And those dosing sessions last a full 8 hours.
The full 8 hours. And they're never left alone to just trip in a dark room.
Right. The clinical trials use this heavy psychological scaffolding. I mean, there are weeks of sober preparation sessions before you ever take the drug, and then weeks of sober integration sessions afterward to unpack whatever trauma surfaced.
And the entire process is guided by a dedicated 2-therapist team. So the molecule and the manualized psychotherapy are inextricably fused together.
Which sounds incredibly labor-intensive.
It is. Very expensive and time-consuming. But the sheer efficacy of that combination is what generated all this hype.
Let's talk about that efficacy. The OOTW Journal breaks down the 2 major phase 3 trials that Lykos Therapeutics ran.
Right. So in the first one, MAPP1, which was published back in 2021 in Nature Medicine, 67% of the participants in the MDMA group no longer met the clinical criteria for a PTSD diagnosis at the 18-week mark.
Wait, 67% compared to what for the placebo?
Compared to only 32% of the people who received the exact same therapy, but with a placebo pill.
I really want to linger on these numbers because in psychiatry, we just do not see leaps like this.
No, we don't.
The researchers calculated an effect size, this metric called Cohen's D, of approximately 0.9. And in statistical terms, a 0.9 is massive.
It's basically unheard of for a psychiatric drug.
Exactly. This isn't just a tiny incremental bump in well-being. For many of these patients, it's a night and day transformation. Yeah. They are going from completely debilitated to functionally cured.
And that wasn't an isolated result either. The confirmatory trial, MAPP2, reproduce those exact findings in an even more diverse patient population.
Oh, wow. What were the numbers there?
In that study, 71% of the MDMA group lost their PTSD diagnosis entirely.
71%.
Yeah, and 46% achieved full remission. And critically, follow-up data suggests these gains are highly durable. Because the patient did the psychological demolition work, the foundation holds.
That makes total sense. But then you have ketamine, which strips almost all of that away, right?
Completely. Because ketamine is forcing the brain to physically grow those dendritic branches. Regardless of what the patient is talking about, the clinical model is built almost entirely for scale and speed.
it's a purely medical, drug-centric model.
Yes. The most widely studied PTSD protocol for ketamine involves 6 intravenous infusions administered over a tight 2-week window.
6 IVs in 2 weeks.
Right, and it's frequently delivered with minimal structured psychotherapy. In routine, off-label practice today, a patient might just go to a clinic, receive the IV infusion over 40 minutes, experience the dissociative, you know, out-of-body effects in a recliner, and then just go home.
Right. But hold on there. A rapid 24-hour response is incredible. I mean, the data from Feathers and colleagues in 2014 showed a single infusion drastically reducing symptoms compared to an active placebo within a single day.
True.
But if the repeated dose trial data also shows that ketamine's benefits tend to fade after a median of just 27.5 days without another infusion, aren't we just talking about an incredibly expensive, highly lucrative Band-Aid?
That's a common criticism.
I mean, if the effects wear off in a month, why would a patient choose that over MDMA's deep root cause processing?
Well, it's really tempting to look at that 27-day relapse window and just dismiss ketamine as a failure of a treatment. But that entirely misunderstands its clinical utility. You really have to evaluate it as a crisis intervention tool.
Okay, how so?
Imagine a patient presenting to a clinic, not just with severe trauma, but with acute suicidal ideation or severe paralyzing comorbid depression.
Oh, I see. You can't just tell that person to hold on for 2 months while they go through MDMA preparation therapy.
Precisely. They do not have the luxury of time for a deep demolition. You need the lights to turn back on today, or they might not survive the week.
Right, it's an emergency.
Yes. And ketamine does something almost nothing else in psychiatry can do. It yanks the patient out of the acute danger zone immediately. Yes, it might require ongoing monthly maintenance dosing to sustain that hardware repair, but it keeps the patient alive.
And functional enough that eventually they might have the stability to engage in deeper psychological work down the road.
Exactly.
Which perfectly frames the dilemma for you, the listener. We have MDMA delivering the 71% remission rate by acting as a psychological catalyst. And we have ketamine yanking people out of suicidal crises overnight by regrowing neural hardware. You would assume these are just the standard of care in every single hospital in the country by now. But the regulatory reality of 2026 is an absolute bottleneck.
It is a massive regulatory traffic jam. Let's look at the FDA hurdle for MDMA first, because despite those unprecedented trial numbers we just talked about, MDMA remains completely unavailable commercially.
It exists solely in clinical trials or extremely limited expanded access programs.
Right, because in August of 2024, the FDA issued what is called a complete response letter to Lykos Therapeutics.
They essentially hit the brakes.
Hard. They declined approval and demanded at least one additional phase 3 trial.
And the reasons they gave are fascinating, specifically this whole concept of functional unblinding.
Yes. Functional unblinding is really the Achilles heel of psychedelic research. In a gold standard clinical trial, neither the patient nor the doctor is supposed to know if the patient received the active drug or the placebo, you know, the sugar pill.
The double blind structure.
Right. That's how we prove a drug actually works, rather than just the patient's expectation making them feel better.
But the FDA pointed out that with MDMA, nearly everyone in the trial correctly guessed which group they were in.
Naturally.
And frankly, how could they not? I mean, if you are given a pill and an hour later you are flooded with oxytocin, your lifelong fear response completely vanishes. And you feel this profound, euphoric connection to your therapists. You know you did not get the placebo.
It's impossible to hide.
But how does a regulatory body even solve that? If a drug's core therapeutic mechanism is a profound, unmistakable psychoactive experience, you can't exactly mask it.
You really can't.
Yeah.
And the FDA's core concern there is expectancy bias. If a patient knows they received this heavily hyped miracle drug, their expectation of getting better artificially inflates the positive results.
Right.
But functional unblinding was actually only half of the FDA's problem. The deeper issue, and really the main reason they denied approval, is that MDMA forces the FDA to evaluate something it was never designed to evaluate, which is talk therapy.
Because the FDA regulates isolated chemical molecules, not human conversations.
It's exactly. For the last 60 years, the FDA's framework has been built to test whether a daily pill, like say a statin for cholesterol, works on a purely biological level. They can mathematically quantify that.
But MDMA is basically completely useless without the 8-hour psychotherapy sessions.
Right. And the FDA expressed deep unease about approving a drug that relies so heavily on the subjective, unquantifiable skill of a human therapist. They don't regulate the practice of medicine or therapy. They regulate chemicals. So faced with a treatment where the chemical and the therapy are completely intertwined, their evaluation framework essentially just broke down.
Wow. Which leaves MDMA locked behind closed doors. But meanwhile, the OATW article describes the current state of ketamine as the Wild West.
Very much so.
Because unlike MDMA, ketamine is available everywhere right now. I mean, there are strip mall infusion clinics in pretty much every major city.
It is ubiquitous. Mm. But we have to be incredibly precise about its legal status here. To this day, no form of ketamine, neither standard generic ketamine nor the patented version of esketamine, is FDA approved for the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Wait, really? So how are all these clinics even operating?
Off-label prescribing. There is a branded nasal spray called Spravato, which is esketamine, but the FDA strictly approved that only for treatment-resistant depression. And it operates under a highly tightly monitored safety program.
Okay, so every single time you see a clinic advertising ketamine specifically for PTSD,
they are operating entirely off-label.
Got it. Now, doctors prescribe drugs off-label every single day. I mean, it is completely legal.
Oh, absolutely.
But the catch for the patient is that off-label means unregulated protocols. Unlike that intensely rigid two-therapist model used in the MDMA trials, off-label ketamine has no standardized playbook.
None at all.
The dosage you get, how often you get it, and whether you are provided with a trained therapist or, you know, just left alone with a pair of headphones, it varies wildly depending on which clinic you happen to walk into.
And that lack of standardization brings us directly to the risk profiles.
Hmm.
Because these compounds are not magic, they are incredibly powerful biological agents with distinct severe side effects.
Right. And anyone considering these treatments really must understand what they're risking. So let's lay out the contrasting risks.
Sure.
MDMA's risks are acute and physiological, meaning they happen mostly during the session itself. We see transient spikes in blood pressure and heart rate. Patients often experience hyperthermia, which is a dangerous rise in body temperature.
Right.
And there is a very real documented risk of hyponatremia,
which is dangerously low blood sodium.
Yeah.
Because MDMA raises body temperature and increases sweating, patients naturally just want to drink a lot of water.
Right. They get thirsty.
Yeah. But MDMA also triggers the release of an antidiuretic hormone, which prevents the body from urinating. So if a patient drinks too much water during the session, their blood sodium actually dilutes to lethal levels.
Oh, wow. So they can't flush the water out.
Exactly. This is why their fluid intake has to be strictly, meticulously managed by the medical team.
But because MDMA is only administered like 2 or 3 times in a patient's entire life and under total supervision, the cumulative long-term toxicity is actually incredibly low.
Yes.
Ketamine, on the other hand, is a completely different beast, largely because of that 27-day relapse window we discussed earlier.
Right, the maintenance dosing.
Yeah. If you have to take ketamine every month to keep your symptoms at bay, you open the door to repeated use risks.
Absolutely. Acutely, ketamine can cause dizziness, severe nausea, and blood pressure spikes. But the most distinguishing long-term danger is a condition called ketamine-induced cystitis.
The article highlights this, and honestly, it sounds horrific. It is severe, sometimes irreversible damage to the bladder.
It is a use-dependent toxicity. The metabolites of ketamine are incredibly harsh on the bladder lining. So with repeated high-frequency use, the bladder physically shrinks and becomes ulcerated.
Which leads to agonizing pain, I'd imagine.
Yes. Furthermore, we cannot ignore that ketamine is a Schedule 3 controlled substance with genuine abuse and dependence potential.
Right.
So when your treatment model relies on ongoing maintenance dosing, the potential for a patient to develop an addiction or suffer permanent bladder damage becomes a highly relevant clinical concern.
So bringing this all together for you, the listener, how do we make sense of these two entirely different approaches? Choosing between MDMA and ketamine is not about crowning a single winner here.
No, it's entirely about the specific context of the trauma.
Context is everything. Ketamine offers rapid, accessible, hardware-level relief for acute crises. If a patient is facing severe comorbid depression or literally cannot survive the week, that rapid synaptogenesis is an invaluable tool to keep them alive. But if a patient is stable enough to seek out highly durable root cause psychological processing, and they are prepared to endure the grueling demolition work of intensive psychotherapy, assuming the FDA ever actually clears the path, MDMA-assisted therapy remains one of the most potent interventions psychiatry has ever seen.
And that actually leads to the final provocative thought I really want to leave everyone with today. It goes all the way back to that 2024 FDA rejection.
Okay, what is it?
Well, if MDMA's incredible 71% remission rate is genuinely the result of the molecule acting in perfect synergy with intensive human connection and psychological support.
Meaning if you literally cannot separate the drug from the talk therapy.
Exactly. Then we have to ask a very uncomfortable question.
Yeah.
Is our modern medical regulatory system, which is a system built over decades strictly to evaluate isolated, mathematically quantifiable chemical compounds, fundamentally unequipped to evaluate and approve the future of mental health treatment?
Wow. That is the question haunting the entire field right now. Because if the answer is yes, then having the greatest psychiatric tools in human history won't matter at all if our institutions just do not know how to legally hand them to the people who are actually suffering.
It's like having the perfect blueprint and all the materials to rebuild that collapsing house we talked about.
But the city refuses to issue the permits because their inspectors only know how to measure the nails.
Exactly.
Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the OOTW Journal's findings. Until next time, keep questioning the narrative.